and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Good evening. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. To the UBC campus, residents of Vancouver, and to all of you on the internet. It is 5:02 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today we'll be bringing you coverage of the BC Native Health Plan, as well as a study on whether the prescription pain reliever Dilaudid as a treatment for chronic heroin addiction. Plus, we will be airing an interview that I myself conducted today with MP Lauren Liu, one of four McGill students who won seats for the NDP in the recent federal election.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
One second, sorry, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties with the computer system here. We're going to go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. So, my name is Iqbal Ahmed.
Saturday, October 15th, WinnieCooper.net presents The Peace Tour Kickoff, featuring Heavy Chains, Cowards, and DJs at the Astoria. Bands start at 10 with DJs between sets and dancing after midnight. Tickets available at the door for The Peace Tour Kickoff, Saturday, October 15th at the Astoria. For more information, visit www.winniecooper.net. Sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is I on
Shindig.
Shindig is CITR's annual Battle of the Bands that goes down 9 p.m. every Tuesday night at the Railway Club until a winner is crowned. October 18th, come out to see The Godspot, Honorary MD, and Velociraptor. October 25th, Shindig brings you The Fathoms, From Birch to You, and Rec Center. Read all about it at shindig.citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM. We'll start off with the local news. On Thursday, the Finance Minister, Jim Flaherty, urged European leaders to make hard choices to solve the global debt crisis. He added that the world has already seen some progress made by them, especially by French and German governments. Flaherty said that if Europe is prepared to act as they need to, he is hopeful that the next G20 meeting will be able to focus on what all those countries will do to support strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. As well, he wants to see credible medium-term plans in countries with large fiscal deficits to start cutting their debt. Flaherty said he's meeting with his Chinese counterpart this Friday to talk about China's exchange rate. He argued the emerging market economies have an essential role to play in rebalancing global demand, and it is necessary for those with fixed exchange rates to put in place measures to allow their exchange rates to appreciate.
Quebec MP Thomas Mulclair launched his bid for the NDP leadership on Thursday by highlighting his political experience, calling for clean and fair competition, and making a promise to build and unite his party. Mulclair kicked off his campaign in Montreal with the endorsement of 33 of his fellow NDP MPs and other high-profile party members, including Lauren Nystrom and New Brunswick NDP leader Dominic Carty. The strong caucus support for Mulclair comes mostly from Quebec, with four MPs from outside the province, all from Ontario. Mulclair laid out the themes for his campaign and described how Jack Layton, the party's leader who died in August, recruited him to the NDP. They worked together to grow the party in Quebec from one seat, Mulclair's, to 59 in the spring election. Mulclair won a by-election in Montreal for the NDP in 2007. After quitting Liberal politics, where he served as a cabinet minister in Premier John Caress' Liberal government. Mulclair said he is not trying to replace Layton, but aims to build upon what he did for the party. Layton led the NDP to official opposition status for the first time in history by winning 103 seats in May. He said the party needs to make breakthroughs outside of Quebec so that it can move from opposition government in the next election, and he positioned himself as the best candidate to do so. Mulclair is joining the race a month after it officially started on September 15th. Brian Topp, the NDP's president, was the first to declare his candidacy, followed by NDP MPs Romeo Saganash, Nathan Cullen, and Paul Dewar. A new Democrat member from Nova Scotia, Martin Singh, is also launched a campaign.
Two children have died after a fire swept through a motorhome in the Fraser Canyon, northeast of Vancouver, overnight this Wednesday, the RCMP said. The children died at the hospital in Kamloops after they were rescued from the burning motorhome, an RCMP officer said on Thursday morning. The children were camping with their grandmother and her common-law husband at a decommissioned airstrip north of Lytton. The man was awakened by the smoke and family dogs barking inside the motorhome, and he managed to pull the children out with the help of other people at the campsite. Ambulance crews transported the four to hospital in Kamloops for treatment, but the children did not survive. The grandmother and her partner are being treated in hospital in Kamloops. The parents of the children, who are from Armstrong, BC, have been notified, said the police.
On Thursday, the planned strike by flight attendants was blocked just hours before it was set to begin. The Canadian Union of Public Employees, which represents 6,800 flight attendants, said it cancelled the strike after Labour Minister Lisa Raitt submitted two referrals to the Canada Industrial Relations Board, on which determines the company as an essential service. CIRB Executive Director Jeanette Brazeau said that the minister's action suspends the workers' right to strike. While a legal strike is not permitted, workers could have gone on wild eat strikes.
Former Manitoba Liberal MP Reg Alcock died from a heart attack on Friday. He was 63. Alcock represented the riding of Winnipeg South in the House of Commons from 1993 to 2006 and was a cabinet minister in the government of Prime Minister Paul Martin. He had suffered weight-related health problems during his political career, once weighing in at 430 pounds. Facing the prospect of severe diabetes, he was ordered to lose almost half of his body weight. During his time in government, Alcock served as president of the Treasury Board from 2003 to 2006 and was the minister responsible for the Canadian Wheat Board during that same time. He lost his seat in the 2006 federal election to Conservative Rod Brunouge by just 111 votes. In January 2007, Reg Alcock was appointed to the faculty of the University of Manitoba as an executive in residence at the I.H. Asper School of Business. Most recently, he was associate dean.
The BC Teachers Federation is sticking to its demand that the provincial government dump 2002 legislation on class sizes, following a decision by the courts not to issue a new ruling on the issue. In April, Justice Susan Griffin ruled the government had allegedly removed the teachers' right to bargain class size and composition. Last month, the union asked the judge to clarify that ruling after negotiations with the government failed to reach an agreement on what the ruling meant. Then on Wednesday, Justice Griffin said it's already clear and she would not issue any clarification. BCTF President Susan Lambert says, in light of a Supreme Court decision, the union will insist that the laws are invalid and should struck from the books. Lambert said she was hoping for more, but she still feels this puts the onus on the government. BC teachers have been engaged in job action since the start of the school year, after their contract expired this summer and they failed to reach a new agreement with the province's school districts.
The Occupy Wall Street protests that are spreading around the globe are significant and justified, said former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev this Thursday during We Day Vancouver. Speaking through an interpreter in Vancouver, Gorbachev said he respected the movement, but warned that unspecified, quote, extremist elements might try to hijack it. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate said that we have to bear in mind is that there is a reason for such a protest. Quote, when we see Americans protesting, I think that means a great deal, unquote, Gorbachev concluded.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Thursday, September 22nd, don't miss The Cove and the Connection to Canada, a free special screening and discussion sponsored by the Center for Coastal Science and Management in the Faculty of Environment at Simon Fraser University. The evening will feature a free screening of award-winning documentary The Cove, with an introduction and discussion with Leah Lemieux, author of Rekindling the Waters, The Truth About Swimming with Dolphins. It's all taking place at SFU Harbor Center, 515 West Hastings in Vancouver. This event will fill up fast, so reserve a seat at sfu.ca/reserve.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
...2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And now for Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Alice Holstein with headlines for FSRN. Fighting broke out in Tripoli today between supporters of Muammar Gaddafi and members of the National Transitional Council, or NTC. It's the first serious gun battle in nearly 2 months and sent at least 9 people to the hospital, according to the BBC. Meanwhile, Amnesty International is calling on the NTC to end the arbitrary detentions and widespread abuse of detainees they say threatens their credibility. Thousands marched across Syria Friday in support of soldiers who have defected from the country's military to the recently formed Syrian Free Army. This follows clashes between the military and its defectors Thursday that the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says left soldiers and civilians dead. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, released a written statement Friday condemning the indiscriminate use of force against peaceful protesters and the shelling of residential neighborhoods in Syria. Her office says the death toll now tops 3,000, including at least 187 children. The U.S. will send around 100 troops to Uganda, President Obama announced in a letter to Congress today. Some already deployed on Wednesday, and the rest will follow later this month. The combat-equipped forces will advise Ugandan soldiers in fighting the Lord's Resistance Army, but won't engage in any combat themselves, except in self-defense. Dozens of people stood on the steps of the state courthouse in New Haven, Connecticut this morning to celebrate an important victory in their fight against police brutality. But other speakers made it clear just how far the community has to go. Melinda Tuhus reports.
No justice!
No peace!
No racist!
No police!
Without admitting fault, the city of New Haven just awarded Abel Sanchez $50,000 in a settlement for the beating he received from Officer Dennis O'Connell several years ago. O'Connell has been the subject of 9 complaints of brutality in the past 6 years, but has been cleared in every case by an internal affairs investigation. Sanchez said the money doesn't make up for his suffering and called for O'Connell to be fired. The settlement is an important step for the African Americans and Latinos who say they've been targeted by rogue members of the New Haven Police Department. The lawyer for Sanchez is filing another brutality case against O'Connell today on behalf of another Latino man who says he was beaten by the officer. Community activist J.O. Richardson said he was shot in the chest by a New Haven cop while sitting in his car with his hands in the air. He's been charged with assault on a police officer and was due in court today.
This is an epidemic. I know countless people that have been victimized by the police.
Today's rally also honored those killed by police officers. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
A federal appeals court issued a ruling today that blocks parts of Alabama's new immigration law, including a provision that public schools check the citizenship of their students, and another that makes it a crime for immigrants to be without proper documentation. However, police will still be able to detain individuals they suspect are in the country illegally. A final ruling on the constitutionality of the law is still many months away. Inmates at California's Pelican Bay Prison temporarily stopped their hunger strike today as their lawyers went into renewed negotiations with the State Department of Corrections. The prisoners are protesting a policy of prolonged solitary confinement, among other conditions they deem inhumane. They first began the hunger strike in July and resumed it in late September when the promised reforms failed to materialize. Demonstrators in San Francisco continue their weeks-long encampment in the city's financial district to protest home foreclosures, bank bailouts, and general inequality. Like other occupations around the country, participants have a need for electricity, and the San Francisco group has found a sustainable way to keep their operation going. Susan Gallimore reports.
At the Occupy San Francisco encampment on Market Street, demonstrators take turns pedaling a stationary bicycle. San Francisco native James Cox Garrity explains the technology behind People Pedal Power.
So what we have essentially is a bike donated from Rock the Bike. It stands about 6 inches from the ground and there's a little motor behind it. So when the wheel spins, the motor spins. We have it directly connected to a battery. Right now it's really basic, but it's definitely getting there, and we have people coming down who really want to help build the system.
Since the group has no backup generator, when one People Power peddler finishes cycling, a call goes up through the crowd for someone else to take over.
We literally have somebody on the bike almost 24/7. It's quite an intense system. You know, we go for maybe 5 minutes without it, and then we do a big shout out. I'm done. Who wants to go next?
The activists hope their system will inspire other occupations around the country to consider a similar system of harnessing the power of the people. Susan Gallimore for FSRN San Francisco.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Washington, D.C., I'm Alice Olson.
Thank you to FSRN for another edition of the headlines for today. It's now time for our weekly human rights segment with Ariel Fournier. First Nations living in British Columbia will soon have much of their health care delivered to them by a separate health authority, following an agreement struck today between the BC First Nations Health Council and provincial and federal health ministries. For more information on this new development, Ariel caught up with Joe Gallagher, CEO of the First Nation Health Council.
What it is the agreement that you've reached with the government and the province of BC?
Okay, so what we reached was a framework agreement, which is a document that flows out of the tripartite First Nations Health Plan that was signed in 2007. And so the framework agreement is the first legal arrangement that's been in place to implement a transition of the Health Canada First Nations Inuit Health resources that provide services to First Nations people in British Columbia to a First Nations health authority that's going to be created, and as well a partnership with the provincial government to work collaboratively on integrating services moving forward.
Okay. So then what would the relationship of this council be with the regional health authorities?
So the First Nations across the province are organized through a regional caucus, which, using the provincial health authority geographic areas as guidelines, the First Nations whose territories cover those regional boundaries work together to establish a regional table to directly link to provincial health services through a relationship with each regional health authority. So the First Nations in that region will work together to identify their health issues and priorities and work to align the work of the regional health authority through its Aboriginal service plan to meet the needs of the First Nations.
Mm-hmm. So you've been working on this proposed plan for quite some time, since 2007. So what are the issues that you felt needed to be addressed by having a separate council?
The issues that needed to be addressed to reach the agreement that we're at now has been a couple of things. One is working with all BC First Nations to agree on a common vision that moving forward in this direction was a good thing to do. We have 203 Indian bands in British Columbia, and each of them, through different arrangements, partnerships, if you will, among themselves, receive services from Health Canada. So what we're looking at was getting the political support for moving in this direction that First Nations political leadership had to provide to the First Nations Health Council to move ahead with concluding the framework agreement. In addition to that, we needed to create an understanding with the provincial and federal governments about the health partnership that we talk about through this framework agreement and the sort of real pieces around moving forward, which include the agreement with Canada on transferring the federal operations in BC region to the First Nations Health Authority and the commitments from the provincial government around the partnerships that are going to be required between First Nations, the First Nations Health Authority, and the regional health authorities and the provincial health system as it exists today.
Mm-hmm. And why is there this need for this separate authority?
The need for it really flows from how important it is for First Nations people to have the ability to make decisions over the health services that are provided to First Nations people in British Columbia. The federal government, in their delivery of services to BC First Nations people, have really done that from a long ways away, where Ottawa is responsible for a lot of the strategic and policy framework that exists in Health Canada that results in services being provided in First Nations communities. And that isn't very responsive to what we need on the ground in British Columbia. In addition to that, the provincial government recognizes that their services being available for First Nations people has to be done in a way where it will benefit First Nations people. The current system in terms of provincial services is one where First Nations people usually enter the provincial health system where there's a high level of acuity in terms of their illness, and we're not using preventative services that the province may have, and the province actually isn't very good at providing the health promotion prevention pieces to meet the needs of First Nations people or other British Columbians, which, as we all know, the provincial government is looking at transforming its health system because the current system isn't sustainable the way that it is. So the plan itself brings forward the notion of First Nations governance of health, and the reason for that being that if First Nations are more involved in design, delivery of healthcare and the services, the decisions around those services, then our health outcomes will eventually improve.
So then on the ground, what kind of problems have cropped up in the past having Ottawa make decisions from so far away?
Well, first of all, what Ottawa has created in British Columbia is they have agreements with either individual bands or small collectives of bands working together in health. And so those service arrangements provide for small operations that are in a lot of ways siloed from one another, so with no economy of scale and very difficult to provide the full scope of benefit or services that people need. They also deliver a non-insured health benefit program to provide for some of the health services that are not covered by the provincial MSP system. And so it created a separate system from the provincial system, and that there's not a lot of integration between the two. And so we have a small federal system, if you will, that operates in isolation and therefore isn't well integrated. And we really don't, it's not a very efficient or effective way of providing services. So with Ottawa also then setting a policy framework on top of that, which then also limits the range or the type of services that are being provided in First Nations communities, it's also, there's an inefficiency and ineffectiveness that way as well.
Mm-hmm. So then what do you think the formation of this means for Aboriginal groups in BC?
The formation of the new health authority and this new governance structure, I think, is a positive step forward for First Nations and Aboriginal people, because it will put decision-making closer to the communities on the ground that are delivering the services. It will provide an opportunity to leverage provincial services in a way that didn't exist before, as partners to delivering health services and to addressing issues of common concern. So I think it gives us an opportunity to see innovation and more meaningful services being delivered on the ground, and that it will, we'll be able to work towards increasing the amount of personal and family and community responsibility for the health of the First Nations and Aboriginal population.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time, Joe Gallagher.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
Thank you for listening. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
October 14th at 560 Seymour, WinnieCooper.net and Mint Productions present Humans Music Video Premiere Party. Vancouver's best electronic act will perform live with San Franciscan French house duo Loose Shoes and other special guests. A top secret after party will go down, but further details are only available at the show. Tickets available at the door for Humans Video Release Party, Friday, October 14th at 560 Seymour. For more information, visit www.winniecooper.net. Sponsored by CITR.
Welcome back to News 101 here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. Next on the show, we go to an interview by Nina Kirigia with MP Lauren Liu, one of the so-called McGill Four, who swept into Parliament this year on the strong surge in NDP support.
The most in your life following the elections?
My new job.
But I mean, like, almost personally, like, going into the personal level, what has changed the most? Just, are you always busy?
Obviously. Yeah, definitely, that's one thing. A typical day in politics doesn't exist, and so just the rhythm of it has taken, we've all needed to adapt to the new rhythm of how fast things happen on the Hill, and also, we've gotten used to super days at, the 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock meetings in the morning, ending at 9 or 10 at night,
wow.
And then going home and being readings or whatever. And it's not always like that, but it's very often like that. So that's been a huge
And these readings and everything, is that because you constantly have to be learning more information about
Canada
and the legal system?
Part of it is to prep for debates in the House. Part of it's for committee work. And so I'm on the Environmental and Sustainable Development Committee.
Uh-huh.
And so that requires a lot of reading. And another thing is just staying up with the news. So getting up early enough in the morning to go read three newspapers at least. And then
those are some of the things you don't really, think about. Obviously, you think there's so much that you have to do, but you really need to know everything. You can't.
It's important.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been asked this, obviously, a bunch of times, how you balance, your life. You're young. You obviously want to go out, live your life, but you also have a very serious job now. How do you balance that?
For the moment, there's no balance.
Oh! It's okay. It'll find itself, I'm sure.
But I've been on the UBC campus today, doing classes and history at SFU, and so this is really fun, and I'm having fun doing this. So work can be fun too.
Yeah.
And
you can find your balance through work, I guess.
Yeah, but it's important for MPs to have a balance, because otherwise you'd burn out.
Yeah.
And you understand that as a student too, because it's so easy to get burned out as a student.
Do you find it hard that you're not always around young people? You know, because I mean, a lot of people and members of parliament, they're older, you're always around older people. Is that hard, or is it, you're kind of used to it by now?
A lot of my colleagues are young as well, and you probably heard about the Miguel Four.
The Miguel Four, yeah, you guys were friends before that, right?
We were friends before. That's awesome. We've been involved with NDP, and so we met each other through the party. Years ago, and so it's kind of cool to have that peer group. But
support, good support, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also really great to have a social life that's really intergenerational, so to interact with people of all ages every
all
day.
Ages. Yeah, no, it's really true. Okay, actually, in response to also the four, there was a lot, you guys were under a lot of scrutiny when everything was first happening. Everybody was talking about, oh, well, they're too young and, like, all that. Has that changed? Do people still scrutinize you, or has that changed?
Yeah, I think that after the elections, there's a lot of scrutiny, but a lot of it was just intrigue and curiosity, and people were trying to figure out who we were and where we came from. I think also within the intrigue, there's a lot of optimism. I think that, you know, we really captured the imaginations of Canadians across the country. And a lot of young people, you know, saw themselves represented in the political system. And so that's been a great thing. In terms of my writing, there, people have really wanted to get to know me, and so there hasn't been a lot of negative scrutiny, but there's been a lot of curiosity and intrigue into who I am as a person as well, which is interesting.
Yeah,
I'll take it.
But I mean, when you look it up, I mean, anything, there's the first thing that always comes up is that issue of, oh, well, they did this, they're too young. There was all this negative, almost gossip about, like, I mean, one thing that I read was they were talking about a girl's Facebook, one of the woman's Facebook, and like how it said something about one of her hobbies, and they publicly put that in the article, and it's like they looked at her personal life as opposed to her now professional life. You know what I mean? So I'm just wondering if, I don't know, if people still do that to you guys.
Not so much. But I think that's also something you have to work against as a young person in politics, because people will try to put you in a box and you know, label you as a young person. But that's not all that you are, and that's not all that I am. You know, we're young people who have ideas about where Canada should be going in the future. So it's really important to make a point of that. But also, you know, people keep saying that youth are apathetic, cynical, and that's not true. But it's, I think it's a huge contradiction to have to say that, but then to criticize and to attack young people when they do get involved in politics and become elected, whether it be on the provincial, municipal, or federal level. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that we should celebrate.
Yeah, I totally do too. I think it's awesome. This is just in regards to the party in general. I mean, after the tragic death, obviously, of Jack Layton, I remember I, as a supporter of NDP, the first thing I thought was, well, what's going to happen now? Like, what's going to happen now that he's gone? Because he held so much of that together. So I'm just wondering, like, in terms of the future of the party, what are some of the things that you have in mind now that he's not there? Has anything changed, or
Well, the huge, one of the largest effects, obviously, of his departure has been the leadership race. And so Jack left us with a great gift, and that was, you know, the race that we made in Quebec and the seats that we won elsewhere in Canada. You know, we don't have a choice but to continue the project that he started. So I heard someone say this once, and I really liked it. They said that, you know, no one can fill Jack's shoes, but we can walk in the path that he showed us. And so I think that
that's really cool.
That really speaks to where we're going. In terms of the leadership race, it's going to be an opportunity for us to talk about where we want to be going as a party. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be an opportunity for us to have that essential debate as to what we are as an opposition party and as a future party for the government. So this is definitely a transitioning point for us. But I think that there's a general consensus that we do want to follow in the general, you know, the general path that it took.
A great piece by Nina Karegia. Next on CITR News 101, we're going to bring you another interview by Ariel Fournier. This time, Dr. Huinia Yuridio-Yuquez on her Salome study, which investigated the controversial clinical use of the painkiller Delada in treating heroin addiction.
In your life, following the elections?
My new job...
You just made the announcement that you are going to start the Salome project. What is this clinical trial?
The Salome study is a clinical trial that is going to test two medications, one of them heroin, and the other one a pain medication licensed in Canada, hydromorphone. And we are going to provide these medications in injectable and oral form. The aim of the Salome study is to engage in the treatment the most vulnerable street heroin users and stop the use of illicit heroin.
And so this project has existed in another incarnation before. It was the Naomi Project. Can you talk about that?
Between 2005 and 2008 in Montreal and Vancouver, we carried out a study called Naomi, where we compared injectable medically prescribed heroin and oral methadone for long-term chronic heroin injectors that were not benefiting from the available treatments. At the end of the study, we showed that for this particular group that had tried previously methadone and did not benefit from it, heroin-assisted treatment worked better. When the study finished, we had 25 participants that were receiving hydromorphone in a double-blind basis to test the presence of a trace of street heroin use in body fluids as a hard marker for street heroin use. And what our surprise is that the majority of the people that were receiving hydromorphone thought that they were receiving heroin, and also that this subgroup, these 25 participants, did as well as those that receiving heroin-assisted treatment. So at the end of the study was a possibility that hydromorphone could be as good as heroin. And given that heroin has a stigma attached because of the strict use of this medication and the baggage that heroin carries, hydromorphone seems to be a good option for the Canadian context.
Mm-hmm. What were the legal restrictions on this study? How was it that you were able to do this study that you measured hydromorphine and heroin?
So for the Salome study, because we are comparing hydromorphone to heroin, and heroin is not licensed in Canada, we need a permit from the Office of Controlled Substances to be able to carry the study, and we obtain what is called an Exemption 56. and in that way we can bring the medication from overseas.
So then before, with Naomi, when the study had to end, had you completed the study?
We completed the study that was 12 months, and every single participant had the chance to stay in treatment for 12 months, and after that they were transitioned to other available treatments. And we submitted the results, positive results, to the authorities, but at that moment Health Canada was not ready to open the door to heroin-assisted treatment in Canada. Therefore, the study finished, and there was no possibility of continuation of the provision of the treatment.
With Salome, do you expect that you'll get similar results as with Naomi?
With the Salome study, we expect to see that hydromorphone, with a bigger sample than the small group that we had in Naomi, we expect to see that participants are doing as well as those receiving heroin. And once we obtain the results, we are going to submit these results to policymakers and the health authorities, and we expect them to consider this treatment as part of the comprehensive response to the addiction problem.
Mm-hmm. And do you, once those results come in, and I know that will be some time away, but do you think that they will take the treatment more seriously now after the Insight Supreme Court decision? Even though these are different avenues, they relate to a similar issue of treatment for heroin users.
Difficult to say what they are going to do. Probably that will be a question for the health authorities. Really, if I knew what they are going to say, will be making my life much easier.
Yeah, certainly. All right, so when will the trial begin then?
We expect to start recruitment at the end of this year.
Okay. All right, well, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ariel, for another great piece. Now we're going to go back to FSRN about the Occupy Wall Street.
As the Occupy movement continues in cities across the U.S., tension has risen as police and local governments attempt to remove protesters from encampments. Some of the actions have led to arrests. Early this morning in Denver, police in riot gear dismantled tents at the site by the Capitol building, arresting 23 people. In Iowa, the state has denied an extension to a permit for the protest site located on Iowa Capitol grounds, setting up a possible confrontation when the permit expires tonight at 11 p.m. But in Manhattan, Occupy Wall Street is declaring victory after New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg backed down on his pledge to clear protesters from Zuccotti Park. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr was at the park and brings us the story.
Thousands at the month-long encampment in Lower Manhattan erupted into applause as word spread that Mayor Michael Bloomberg called off his promise to evict the protesters. Owners of the public-private Zuccotti Park had issued a 7 a.m. deadline for protesters to leave, ostensibly to clean up unsanitary conditions. But Occupy Wall Street participants resisted. They organized their own park cleanup and called on supporters for help. Among them was New York City Councilwoman Letitia James. She says this moment marks defeat for the mayor's administration.
When we are united, we can never be defeated. And that is the message here today. This is a teaching moment to our society that ideals that we believe in, which are embedded and shredded in our Constitution, cannot be defeated. And so to the mayor of the city of New York, obviously you don't have enough spray and enough jails to house all of these individuals who came out here today. And we stood up today, and we stood up against those forces who would like to silence the First Amendment and silence a growing movement.
Thursday night, cleaning crews doubled their efforts to sweep and mop the park, where thousands have congregated on a daily basis, to meet, share meals, and take part in the participatory decision-making body, the General Assembly. 21-year-old Niral Shah says he came to defend Occupy Wall Street because he supports a space to challenge corporate domination of the political and economic system.
You know, there's obviously a lot of anger about Wall Street specifically, but there's a much bigger and longer trend of a narrative about full faith in markets substituting for the public interest, ignoring the fact that people can't afford educations, that student loan debt isn't dischargeable, that our income tax system has gotten less and less progressive, that people can't afford health insurance, that people can't even afford housing.
The mayor's office and park owner, Brookfield Financial, were flooded by calls, including from local lawmakers demanding a halt to the eviction. Unions, including the UAW and AFL-CIO, came out in support of the protesters. The progressive group Move On said it delivered a petition with 340,000 signatures opposing the eviction. Tenants' rights organizer Esther Wang credits this victory to the movement's broadening base of support.
That's right. I think, you know, as time has gone on, people have realized that those who really have been most impacted by the economic crisis, really by decades of systemic oppression and inequality, these are the people who actually need to be involved in the protests. And I think everybody's understanding that. Unions, community organizations, ordinary residents who aren't maybe affiliated with any organization, the protesters themselves. And it's really beautiful and I think positive to really see this movement becoming, you know, more multi-generational, more multiracial.
According to police, 8 to 10 protesters were arrested later in the morning as celebrating campers attempted to march onto Wall Street itself. Organizer Yotam Merom says he expects an even greater turnout at Saturday's global October 15th mobilization.
Action, there are going to be people having protests and bank sit-ins and all sorts of different actions all over the world and all over the country and over 500 cities. There are going to be online actions. There are going to be creative, artistic actions all over the city. People are going to be struggling over housing and education and jobs and the war and the environment all over the city all throughout the day, doing a lot of different kinds of creative actions, all culminating at Times Square at 5 p.m. for a sort of like massive show of force.
The mayor insists the eviction at Zuccotti Park has only been postponed and could happen any day. But the protesters say they will continue to be ready to block any such action and vow to remain in the park through the winter months. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
Thank you to FSRN for those that story. Just another point mentioning Wall Street and Occupy Wall Street. There will be an Occupy Vancouver happening tomorrow, Saturday, October 15th. CJ, I know me and you are going to be there. What are your thoughts?
Well, News 101 is definitely going to be there reporting live. We won't have a show tomorrow, but we will have interviews and possibly maybe even bring somebody over to our studio to talk about it.
Yeah, and we'll try and, you know, maybe get some interviews in with people tomorrow, see who's going to be there, see the type of...
see the crowd, basically.
The crowd, yeah, and how it's laid out. We already talked with...
John Hayes, a member of the Occupy Vancouver demonstrations. John definitely had some interesting points to bring up, and I really liked their umbrella statement.
Yeah, they're also, I really liked how organized they were. They have kind of got everything down in terms of what's going to be happening tomorrow, in terms of structure.
Exactly. If you look at their website at occupyvancouver.org, or it could be .com, Google it, you will see that they're very structured, very organized, and so, but that's besides the point. .org. .com. Sorry.
So that will be...
what?
What's the website?
OccupyVancouver.com.
OccupyVancouver.com, if you want to know anything about it, and you can see their structure and what's going to be happening tomorrow.
And of course, if you are listening, you are more than welcome to join those demonstrations. Definitely bring food and water and peace and love. If you can.
But News 101 will also stay neutral in its coverage of Occupy Wall Street, as responsible journalists always do.
Okay.
Of course.
We'll try our best.
Iqbal.
We'll have split personalities and try to do our best as journalists.
Basically, we'll be there and see what it's like, and if you don't want to go, yes, at least go just to see.
Although, jokes aside, I do want to talk to them about their political agenda, because all of us in this room do agree that there's not much that they can change within the Canadian system, because, frankly, our Canadian system is doing quite well.
Yeah, and actually, I'm Iqbal Ahmed, the one who's been producing the show all day, but I'm going to jump inside this conversation. We'll kind of make a panel talk now.
Sure.
And so, CJ, you had an interview with one of the organizers this past Monday,
John Hayes.
And I've noticed you're pretty well read, mentioning the umbrella statements and stuff. And if you can answer this, what are their views on the Canadian system? Because Occupy Wall Street is so kind of focused on the U.S. finance system, these big U.S. banks, the big U.S. bailout, TARP, all these things. But when you translate it to Canada, you know, when you bring it over the border, what characters of it do you think that change?
We actually asked John what their Canadian agenda was, and he didn't quite sidetrack it, but he did say that the purpose of Occupy Vancouver, and generally the purpose of all Occupy movements around the world, is to show their solidarity towards Occupy Wall Street originally.
And I noticed that they kind of changed it in terms of, I mean, I remember the very first statement of that umbrella was recognizing the fact that First Nations, this is happening on First Nations land.
Yeah.
And so they have a lot of respect for the First Nations people, and that I really give them kudos for that, because usually in movements happening like this, sometimes principal factors like that are forgotten, like the fact that everything we do, this university that we're sitting in right now, is on the land of First Nations.
Well, I mean, technically, even New York Island is on First Nations.
But they have a lot more. Like they made it specifically for that. If you're talking about what's different between Wall Street and Vancouver, mm-hmm. that's one of the differences, that they're highlighting that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'd say, but
I get your question, Iqbal. What they're trying to say is that they're trying to they recognize
are they going to attack like Mark Carney and say like, you know, like, rather than Bernanke say, well, maybe we should audit the Bank of Canada rather than the Federal Reserve. Maybe we should, like, these things
well,
like that.
And they recognize that.
And antitrust is very different in Canada than it is in the United States. We have more regulations than the United States, especially with the United States getting rid of, like, things like Glass-Steagall, you know? And there's, like, there are very tangible things that the... And the bailout of big banks.
Yeah, which did not happen here.
Yeah, exactly. So I think...
And neither did mortgage-backed securities. We didn't have those because the regulations do not allow that here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and so I feel like a lot of Occupy Wall Street is about regulations. It's about... Or not maybe... It's about more transparency.
But it's also about that the gap between the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
And John definitely highlighted in Canada.
Yeah, okay.
And that is present in Canada. And I think also this is adding to the fact that this is starting to be a world movement and not just something that happened in New York. And it may be part of what's happening in Vancouver is to add to that, maybe not specifically to have their own thing, but just to be part of it.
And the reason it's happening across the world is because it's true that there is an income gap throughout the world, right? You know? Do you agree with that? There definitely is.
There is, and especially in the United States, they say the United States' income gap is more than places like maybe even China and India, because we have a large middle class, but our rich are super rich. So I think it's kind of inflated on one end rather than maybe low on the other. And I feel like Occupy Wall Street in America has a very different tincture, because America, at least depending who you believe, has this big concept of kind of raise yourself in your own bootstraps, like American capitalism, American self-sustainability, and this time of wealth distribution, which, if you remember by anything President Obama did in America, they all say it's socialism, wealth distribution, which in Canada we don't have as much trouble with, you know? The NDP is our official opposition.
But, I mean, saying that, the NDP is our official opposition now, but hasn't, that's as of not even a year ago, so...
But, I mean, in the past, Canada has been more socially progressive, you can say, than the United States. I mean, it's social progressive fiscally and in other ways. I mean, we have gay marriage here. We have free healthcare. We're much more, I mean, taxes are more, like, things like that. But back to maybe what Nina said earlier about the whole First Nations thing. I mean, that's a really interesting thing. It adds a very Vancouver element to what it is. It makes it much more Canadian. But I think when they pursue things like that, they're great gestures, but they might be mixing the issues.
That's what I was just thinking. Like, there's already so much being talked about just in Wall Street, New York, and then all of a sudden Vancouver comes in with these other ideas, and it just makes this whole thing have so many more issues, and it's almost become
I would just like to get you guys' thoughts on one thing, because so many of these Occupy Wall Street guys are big on comparing themselves to the Arab Spring, which is
I disagree with it.
So we're all excited about that. Yeah. But one of the major divides is it that they can protest, which is right, but they also have their vote.
But that's the thing that they're trying to compare themselves with, the idea of expressing their democracy.
But they have democracy.
Yeah, like, but they have democracy. But just because we're saying that we live in a place that we have democracy.
But they don't usually exercise a right to use it.
And then that's your fault for not exercising.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you can...
I don't know.
What percentage of Americans vote in the previous election?
Did you know?
Less than 50%.
No, I'm disregarding that. I'm disregarding that when I say this, but I know that we live in a democracy, but there's also a lot of things that are wrong.
America's not
a
democracy.
I don't think it's right. I don't think it's right.
Yeah.
It's a constitutional republic.
It's a republic. We all agree with it. But on the local level, on the federal level, you do get to directly elect your leaders.
But there are a lot of problems with our so-called democracy that we live in. So it's not okay to say to fully compare it, but I think it is okay to compare it in some sense.
Well, I would say that at least in America compared to Canada, there's much more direct democracy. You directly elect your senators, which you never used to, but now you directly elect your senators. You directly elect your house, and I mean, you indirectly elect president too. So, I mean, these things are great, I feel, for bringing awareness, but I feel like when it actually comes to things to change, this could put pressure on the president to change things because he sees this as an electorate. The election is coming up soon.
Yeah.
But I think what they need to do is continue their momentum into the election and kind of shove these issues down the throat of the people in the next election. And if they don't do that, what can they really change? Nina? Looks like we're... we'll be right back.
Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
And that's our program for October 14th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurigia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed with help from Louise, Nina, and Chirag. From the entire news team here at News 101, CITR 101.9, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Soul Throats. Clapping hands. So, my bad. Stay tuned for Stranded with Matt.